This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 5th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, elections in Mexico show a shifting political landscape. We'll go over the results from the weekend's voting. The federal government announces new funds for solar energy. And we'll go to the Poor People's World Cup in Cape Town, where athletes and activists are raising awareness about poverty and inequality in South Africa.
Football is my life. If I go, I will be a great star, and I will give the people. The people don't have money, don't have houses, and I have money, I will give her my friend.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Israel says today that more cargo trucks will be allowed to enter Gaza and also released a list of goods that will not be allowed in. Cement, steel, and some other raw building materials will now be permitted, but only for Palestinian Authority projects or those undertaken by international entities. Also in Gaza today, Israeli naval vessels opened fire on fishermen, FSRN's Rami Almagari reports.
The decision to relax entry restrictions excludes the Gaza Sea, and Israeli naval forces continue to prevent fishing deep off Gaza shores. Today, medical sources say a fisherman was wounded on board his boat of Gaza City. Also, Israeli vessels opened fire on fishermen on board boats of the southern shores of Rafah and Khan Yunis cities. No injuries were reported. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights in Gaza reports that at least two fishermen have been injured by Israeli naval vessels since the beginning of 2010. The Gaza-based agriculture ministry says that 400 fishing boats are no longer functioning. In June 2007, Israel imposed a comprehensive blockade on Gaza, including its 40-kilometer coastline, making it difficult for Palestinian fishermen to ply their trade. Israel restricted fishing areas that had extended 12 nautical miles offshore before the blockade were reduced to just 2 to 3 nautical miles from land. Rami Almagari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
The capital of the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region in Urumqi was quiet today on the anniversary of last year's unrest. 197 people died, some 1,700 were injured. When the violence between Uyghur and Han Chinese subsided, authorities detained hundreds of mostly Uyghurs and sentenced 25 people to death. In advance of today's anniversary, Chinese authorities installed about 40,000 high-definition cameras in public areas around the capital. China has also implemented a number of social programs to address the underlying causes of tension between the Uyghurs and the Han Chinese, including unemployment. Across India today, a general strike was observed over escalating fuel costs. Jasvinder Sehgal has more.
Today's dawn-to-dusk nationwide strike grounded air travel, disrupted trains and parked buses and trucks. Shops and schools closed in many parts of the country. The protest was called after the Indian government ended curbs on petroleum pricing and hiked the prices of diesel, kerosene and cooking gas. Brinda Karat, spokesperson of the Communist Party, says that the agitation is not intended to gain political mileage, but rather to call attention to the plight of the common citizen.
Price hike of all petroleum products, kerosene, gas, diesel, petrol, this is going to have a cascading impact. So this is not anything to do with this or that political party. This is against the government policies which affect all sections of the people, particularly the poor.
Police detained nearly 10,000 demonstrators in the state of Maharashtra, where hundreds of buses were damaged. Many opposition leaders courted arrest in support of the shutdown. The Associated Chambers of Commerce and Industry estimates that the strike cost the country more than $20 million. Jasvinder Sehgal, FSRN India.
Poland's interim president has now officially prevailed in presidential elections. Bronislaw Komorowski defeated Jarosław Kaczynski, the identical twin brother of the nation's late president. Some analysts say President Komorowski's Civic Platform Party will continue to roll back the socially conservative pro-welfare policies of the former president. And clashes continue for the fifth day in Mogadishu, where Somali and African Union troops battling extremist rebel militias have killed dozens and wounded hundreds. Abdul Karim Jamali reports for FSRN.
At least 60 people have been killed and nearly 150 others injured in the crossfire. Most of the victims were civilians. Two peacekeepers are among the dead. Hundreds of families have fled their homes. The violence began July 1st, after Hizbul Islam ordered the media not to broadcast on the country's Independence Day, but the local media refused to follow the orders. Mortar fire across the city followed, and has continued since. Somali President Sharif Sheikh Ahmed said today that the nation is in the hands of Al-Qaeda and extremist groups. The African Union has ordered another 2,000 peacekeepers to the region. Abdul Karim Jamale, FSRN.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. In Mexico, preliminary results from voting over the weekend show the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, as the winner of most of the local offices in 14 states. The party ruled the country for more than 70 years up until 2000. There were also some surprising losses for the PRI in some local contests, and violence and intimidation closed some polling stations. For more, we're joined by Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program of the Center for International Policy in Mexico City. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you very much for the invitation to be on the show.
Results are still being counted, but the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, seems to have strong leads in many of the gubernatorial races in the states. What do these results mean for the PRI and for President Calderon's National Action Party?
That's right. It looks like they've won at least 9 out of 12 governorships in these elections. It's unusual here. Usually one thinks that the party to beat in elections is the incumbent party. But in this case, everyone was looking to see what was going to happen with the PRI. What we're seeing here is an incredible comeback when you think that it was the third party. It was trailing both the National Action Party of the right and the Party of the Democratic Revolution of the left just 3 years ago. And yet now it looks like it's favored to win the presidential elections of 2012. In a last-ditch attempt to try to hold off the growing power of the PRI, the PRD and the PAN, the right wing and the left wing, have a severe and very deep historical differences, actually formed coalitions in 6 of the states and were able to beat back the PRI in, looks like, probably 3 of those states.
Well, let's talk about that coalition for a moment. That's the Democratic Revolution Party, as you mentioned, the left-wing party joining forces with PAN, President Calderon's conservative party, in states like Oaxaca and Puebla. It seems like they have defeated PRI. Is this a viable coalition moving forward?
This is probably not a viable coalition for presidential elections. The differences between them are too profound, and they would have to give up their principles or any kind of coherence in an ideological sense in order to go to presidential elections with this kind of a coalition. I think that the rationale behind it was purely pragmatic. It was obviously purely pragmatic. What they were thinking is that we have to hold back the PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, from gaining too much momentum in these elections that would take it into the 2012 presidential elections, so that we can at least have a competitive field when we get to those elections.
Now, there were reports of polling stations closed due to violence. Some candidates even cast their votes while wearing body armor. What was the influence of drug traffickers and violence on this election?
We do know that there were not a lot of violent incidents directly related to the elections. There were the usual. There were bodies found hanging from international bridges, but they seem to be tied to something that unfortunately is now a daily occurrence here in Mexico, the rivalries between the drug gangs and with the security forces. Fortunately, there wasn't a lot of election-related violence. So that was one of the good things that happened yesterday. On the other hand, there certainly are a lot of reports that poll watchers refused to go to the polls, that some polls didn't even open, that we had, even leading up to the elections, a number of candidates that dropped out of the races because of death threats against them. So it's very difficult to quantify so far, and we know that this is happening primarily in some of the border states. Tamaulipas, where the governor, the candidate who was slated to win the governorship, was assassinated just 6 days before the election.
As you mentioned, the presidential election is set for 2012. There's this unusual coalition with a right-wing party and the left coming together this time. What do these results offer in terms of indicating what could happen the next couple of years leading up to the next election?
Essentially, what we're seeing is a strong showing by the PRI. And they had already gone into these elections with their candidate, and of course the candidates are not even named, but people basically know, at least in some parties, and particularly in the PRI, who they're going to put forth. In this case, it's the governor of the state of Mexico, Enrique Peña Nieto, was already going in with a very strong position. So they will come out of this even stronger, and as I say, the fact that the coalition is not likely to hold into the presidential elections means that they have to build from here on the basis of the new territorial strength and to begin to formulate candidacies that would be able to confront the pre-candidate and the pre-machine that ran the country for 70 years.
Laura Carlson is the director of the Americas Program for the Center for International Policy in Mexico City. She joined us to talk about early results from the local elections over the weekend. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The FIFA Soccer World Cup is approaching an end in South Africa, with the final scheduled for next weekend. As the games come to a close, many are questioning the benefits organizers of the mega tournament promised to bring to the country, where many live in poverty and lack access to housing, electricity, and water. Activists and athletes are highlighting the plight of the poor in a parallel tournament called the Poor People's World Cup. Some 36 teams from 40 Cape Town communities are competing. FSRN's Davison Makanga attended one of the games and files this report.
I love soccer. It's like me, man.
Trinan Davis can't stop talking about his passion for soccer when I ask him why he likes the game. Known to his peers as Kaka, after the Brazilian soccer star, the 18-year-old impressively juggles the soccer ball. For now, though, his skill counts for little. Davis and some 400 players are participating in the Poor People's World Cup at the periphery of Cape Town's Athlon Stadium. Many of these athletes say playing for professional teams is a far-fetched dream. They feel unrecognized, as neither high-ranking officials from FIFA nor local leaders have accepted their invitation to attend the alternative games.
So what we want is just the mayor to come out with a few coaches and come look for and come scout some of the players. Even if they don't scout me, even if they take one player out of this tournament, then they can say, nah, we did a good thing, yapping one player at least, you see. It's not. We don't want them to scout all of the players, at least one out of the group.
David's teammate, Clinton Peterson, expresses frustration at the lack of recognition by leaders. He says his goal of playing for Liverpool Football Club might remain just a dream. However, it's the lack of basic needs such as shelter and water that frustrates 19-year-old Peterson the most.
I stay there in Tiaf. I don't even have a big house. If I turn, my head knock against the wall. You see, because I don't have a house. I live there in a small hockey.
By a small hockey, Peterson refers to the small wooden shack he shares with three members of his family in Cape Town's crime-ridden area of Delft.
The government can look after us like they look after the foreigners, you see? Even the crime as well. They hired a lot of securities and policemen just for the foreigners. Now, why can't they do that for our safety, the citizens of South Africa? That's why we must work together and go to the government and tell them, just build big houses for us. Not even big, just one room, two rooms. You see, we don't want a lot of money, just a few houses.
For some spectators, attending the tournament is a way of temporarily escaping tough living conditions. Vandu Lingane is among the 200 fans attending the Poor People's World Cup. The self-trained electrician lives in an informal settlement, ironically called Sweet Home.
I want a job, I want to work only, because now I'm not working. I'm not working.
This is 50 cents, this is 1 rand, that's 2 rand.
This is Joanne Dexter, a 54-year-old taking care of 5 people. She's here selling sweets to make a little money. But she says she could have made better profits had she been selling her goods at FIFA World Cup stadiums. Like many informal vendors, Dexter was not allowed to do business at the stadiums during the Soccer World Cup due to FIFA bylaws that give preference to official sponsors.
Yeah, really sad for me, really. I mean, people struggle, and if people want to put something on the table, they can sell absolutely nothing, no stalls, nothing going on here.
The general sentiment by the poor here is probably summed up by the aspiring soccer star Davids, who challenges the government to do what he would do if he secures a job in professional leagues.
Football is my life. If I go, my friend, I will be a great star and I will give the people. The people don't have money, don't have houses, and I have money, I will give her, my friend.
Davison Makanga, FSRN, Cape Town.
Join FSRN Tuesday, July 6th for an exclusive report on private security companies in Pakistan, some of them with links to US-based firms. We'll take you to Peshawar to hear directly from locals who work for security companies about what their lives are like.
I can never even think of buying meat or fruit for my family, not even in my dreams. My children are in school. I can't afford the family expenses on my small salary. I trespass time in life. I'm deprived of my basic right.
12-hour shifts, 7 days a week, no vacation, salary cuts, and for those who die on the job, little or no compensation for the family. The lives of locals in Pakistan working for international security companies, that story tomorrow on FSRN. Two new reports indicate the modern-day slave trade, known as human trafficking, is one of the world's largest and fastest-growing criminal enterprises. A United Nations report released last week estimates human traffickers in Europe alone earn around $3 billion a year by forcing their victims into prostitution or other unpaid work. In June, the U.S. State Department issued its annual assessment of human trafficking worldwide and, for the first time, evaluated the modern slave trade within its own borders. The most prevalent form of human trafficking in the U.S. is forced prostitution, but slavery also extends to other sectors such as agriculture, domestic work, and manufacturing. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke about shared responsibility during the presentation of the 2010 Trafficking in Persons report.
All of us have a responsibility to bring this practice to an end. Survivors must be supported and their families aided and comforted, but we cannot turn our responsibility for doing that over to non-governmental organizations or the faith community. Traffickers must be brought to justice. And we can't just blame international organized crime and rely on law enforcement to pursue them. It is everyone's responsibility. Businesses that knowingly profit or exhibit reckless disregard about their supply chains. Governments that turn a blind eye or do not devote serious resources to addressing the problem. All of us have to speak out and act forcefully.
California lawmakers are currently considering legislation that would require large retailers and manufacturers in the state to inform the public about what measures they do or do not take to ensure slave labor is not part of their product supply chain. One NGO that helps companies to identify human trafficking risks is Verite. The organization's executive director, Dan Viederman, says companies wanting to ensure that slavery is not part of the chain of supply can first look for a common indicator.
And the company that's selling the good often doesn't have any real idea of what the working conditions are in that factory that they've engaged or that farm that they've engaged. And so the first step that we can do is help them just understand what the risk is. And the thing we're trying to do with this report is to say that there is a very simple mechanism, a very simple way in which they can better understand the risk, and that is to identify if any of the workers have been placed in that farm or in that factory by a middleman, by a labor broker. And if they have, we can then help them put in place systems to help them respond to that problem.
Viderman also says that securing the chain of supply is a shared responsibility between various stakeholders. He urges consumers to educate themselves about their favorite brands and to ask questions about the origins of products. Some English courts have just finished a controversial one-year pilot project where defendants make their preliminary court appearance not in person but by video link from the police station. The British government says this modernization of the criminal justice system is faster and cheaper than transporting people to court, but critics say it can have a negative influence on the judicial process. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
I'm at Camberwell Green Magistrates Court, one of Britain's busiest, and I've just been watching the proceedings of some video link cases taking place in virtual courts. I'm not allowed to record the hearings, but it's a bit like a Skype or conference call, only with big wall-mounted screens where the court can see and speak with the defendant who's sitting in the police station. In most cases, their lawyers are in the courtroom itself, not with their defendant at the police station. I asked defendants and their families here waiting for their second physical court appearance what they think about video link.
In one way, I may say it's not okay, because when you get arrested and probably you don't know what happened, and you don't know what to say, and you might say what you're not supposed to say, there might be more pressure in the police if they try to change a word into my mouth. Yeah, I would prefer to go to court. I feel safer.
I'd rather them come into court, because if they're sitting now here, then they'll have time to think rather than having a video link in custody. I think they would feel more pressured.
I think it would be a good thing to get it done and dusted in the police station, as I think it's a quicker way of dealing with cases instead of coming to court and have the defendant hanging around all day. I guess if they're doing video link, they have the option to have a solicitor with them to give them legal advice in the police station as well as in court.
But according to defence lawyer Greg Stewart, that's not the case.
On the virtual court, what we have found is that levels of representation have been stubbornly low in terms of people actually instructing a lawyer.
You mean that people who appear in video link are less likely to have a lawyer representing them?
Exactly.
Why would that be?
Well, it's not in the interest of the police to encourage them to be legally represented. They find it easier to get the result they want, usually a conviction, if the person's unrepresented and not aware of the law or their rights to challenge evidence. During the pilot over the last year at Camberwell, sometimes less than half the defendants are represented. It's a no-brainer, isn't it? If you're entitled to free and independent legal advice and your liberty is at stake, you'd always ask to speak to a lawyer, wouldn't you?
For those appearing physically in court here, there's a duty lawyer on call who checks with each defendant if they want advice and representation. In this court, an estimated 85 to 90% of people take that option. Lawyers like Greg Stewart, who initially boycotted video link hearings, say this scheme doesn't save time or money. The police station isn't a neutral place, and it's just not equipped to function as a pseudo-courtroom.
The custody sergeant, when carrying out a busy job, particularly in urban police stations, has not got the time or the skills to assess whether or not there are mental health issues or other issues, which mean that that person really should be physically produced at court so they can be assessed properly by probation, mental health services, and have face-to-face discussions with a lawyer who can pick up issues about their welfare or their offending or their ability to understand what's going on.
The new British government has yet to announce what they'll do with virtual courts now that this pilot scheme is over. A group of British lawyers may now mount a legal challenge in the European Court. Other European countries are watching what happens here. They're considering using video link in this way in their own legal systems. Naomi Fowler, FSRN, London.
Yeah. If you've considered installing solar energy in your home and then backed away because of the price, you're not alone. The large initial investment usually pays for itself over the 20-year lifespan of the solar panels, but that's a long time to wait. Some new federal initiatives could help make it more affordable to go solar without costing taxpayers. Tanya Snyder reports.
Over the 4th of July weekend, environmental activists called for a declaration of the country's independence from its addiction to oil. And President Obama answered their call.
Today I'm announcing that the Department of Energy is awarding nearly $2 billion in conditional commitments to two solar companies.
The money's in the form of loan guarantees for low-interest financing, not outright grants. Three-quarters of it will go to Abengoa Solar, a Spanish company that's become a leader in solar technology. The loan guarantees will help Abengoa secure financing to build the first large-scale solar plant in the country to generate and store energy.
And it will generate enough clean, renewable energy to power 70,000 homes.
While it might seem strange for stimulus money to go to a foreign company, Monique Hannes of the Solar Energy Industries Association says that's the result of the low priority the U.S. has given to solar energy production until now.
Frankly, other countries are ahead of us, and so the other companies from those countries are more competitive.
Besides producing energy for U.S. consumers, the project will also create an estimated 1,600 construction jobs. Abengoa's U.S. headquarters is in Colorado, and its new plant will be in Arizona. Another Colorado company, Abound Solar Manufacturing, will get the remaining $400 million of loan guarantees to make solar panels at its current facility and at a new plant in Indiana. Mark Chen is Abound's director of marketing.
By increasing our production scale and capacity, we can further drive down the costs of our product and therefore the cost of solar electricity.
Abound estimates it will create up to 1,500 permanent new jobs, not just temporary construction jobs. The investment into solar technology comes at the same time as some bad news for another well-regarded solar program. The PACE program gives homeowners a way to finance the addition of solar panels by letting them add the cost to their property tax bill, paying it off over the course of decades. But the Department of Energy is wrangling over details with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Monique Hannes of the Solar Energy Industries Association explains.
The concern of the PACE financing is that it changes the order of the first lien on a property so that if there is any problem with a mortgage, property taxes get paid off first. So theoretically, the investment in the solar energy property would get paid off first.
But she's optimistic they'll sort it out quickly.
Adding solar actually adds value to a property.
While the investments in renewables are a step in the right direction, many environmentalists say they're no substitute for the real goal, comprehensive energy legislation that will reduce carbon emissions. The legislation currently stalled in the Senate is controversial in the environmental community for the concessions it makes to fossil fuel industries. And the solar sector has been disappointed that it doesn't do more to jumpstart large-scale energy production from renewables. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Washington, D.C. editor was Tanya Snyder. Today's technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. Major funding for Free Speech Radio News comes from the Pacifica Foundation, community radio stations nationwide, and individual donors. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doran Marina.